Today on Against the Grain, should fiction, in the form of novels and films, promote empathy? Do fictional narratives in fact generate empathy in the hearts of readers and viewers? I'm CS. The writer and scholar Namwali Sirpal pushes back against a lot of conventional thinking on the subject. She joins me, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. If we empathize with people we read about in novels or see in films, if we feel their pain and sorrow, that, we are told, is a very good thing. It may change the way we perceive the world. It may motivate us to take action to alleviate suffering, tackle inequality, or address the way certain people are treated or marginalized. Or, argues Namwali Sirpal, perhaps empathy of the emotional sort shouldn't be, or isn't, what narrative art promotes at all. Perhaps it does or can promote something else, something that affects and elevates us in a different way, something that spurs us to formulate opinions, political opinions, that are closer to the truth. Namwali Sirpal is an award-winning Zambian writer and an English professor at UC Berkeley. Her debut novel, just published, is The Old Drift. Sirpal wrote an essay entitled The Banality of Empathy that appeared on the NYR Daily website. When Namwali Sirpal joined me recently in studio, I asked how she would define empathy.
Empathy is a relatively old concept. We can really trace it back to Adam Smith, the philosopher, in the 18th century, where he talked about sympathy. And the way he defined it is very much how we think about empathy now. I think there are different connotations to the two words, but they're roughly equivalent if we think about his definition of it in the 18th century. And it really, for Smith, was about taking on the perspective of another person and feeling with them. And he sort of put this as a centerpiece of ethical relationships and was very interested in reconceiving morality around the notion of other people rather than around the notion of laws and rules that you followed on your own based on tradition. And George Eliot, the novelist in the 19th century, picked up on the notion of sympathy and carried it into the idea of art. And Eliot's claim was that if art does not enlarge men's sympathies, it does nothing morally. And she was thinking specifically about narrative art, about the novel, and a lot of the work that literary critics have done in this field of ethics and literature has followed from this sympathy model or empathy model of reading. I think when we think about empathy in the 21st century, some of its tenor has shifted. I think it's gotten a bit more intense than either Eliot or even Adam Smith conceived it. So now we have this idea that we feel the pain of others. When we empathize with them, we are not just putting ourselves in their shoes. We're not just walking a mile in their shoes, as the phrase goes, but we are actually becoming them. We're taking on their being for the period or the duration of the literary or artistic experience.
And who has articulated that kind of vision of empathy in contemporary times?
So in my essay, I look to Karl Ove Knausgaard's acceptance speech for the 2015 World Literature Prize. And he's
the guy who wrote the 6-volume My Struggle autobiographical novel.
Yeah, it's this kind of opus. And he doesn't actually use the word empathy in this essay, but I felt like he described very accurately our sense of how empathy works with literature in the 21st century, specifically in contrast with the depiction of other people in the news media. So he's creating this kind of dynamic argument between the depiction of others, a kind of remote drone's eye view of other people that he sees on television and in the news. And he's opposing that to the way that the novel, which he sees as morally better than the news, how the novel depicts other beings. And he calls this a kind of vanishing point. So, for example, he says, the instant a novel is opened and a reader begins to read, the remoteness between writer and reader dissolves. The other that thereby emerges does so in the reader's imagination, assimilating at once into his or her mind. And he presents this as the kind of idiosyncratic particular and singular vision. The novel represents the opposite, he says, of the media's generalized and universal depiction of other people. And he says that this is a better thing, that it's better for us to understand other people empathically through the novel than through kind of news depictions of the suffering of others.
So this assimilation of the reader into this, say, the character, the person of the character, the fictional character they're reading about, this dissolving of the boundary, this does suggest, as you write, a kind of incredibly close melding, perhaps. Could one say melding of the viewer, the reader, and the hero, for example?
Yeah, I think this is the kind of mind meld or dissolve between self and other that I think we recognize when we get caught up in the feelings and thoughts of a character when we're reading. The idea that Nausgaard kind of presents is that this is a moral good. And even though he says this is kind of a banal model of ethics, I think it does characterize the way that we talk about art, especially narrative art in the 21st century. The idea that when we go to see a movie like The Hate U Give, which is about police brutality, the purpose of that is that it's a tool for empathy. And we think about novels in this way as well. It's good to read novels about refugees or about immigrants because somehow that will allow us to empathize with their situation.
And I guess the theory goes that somebody who encounters art in narrative form, for example, a film, a work of theater, a novel, a short story, that empathy that they acquire while they're consuming this work makes them act differently, like actually does something to what they go out and do after they put down the novel.
Yes, there's very much the idea that, you know, we have an empathy deficit, as some people are calling it, in contemporary society, and that works of art that allow us to empathize with other people are a kind of moral training for us. Once we've experienced the other in this projection of the self into these characters, it somehow makes us more open to real people who are unlike us once we leave the movie theater, once we close the book.
Okay, so this is sort of rather conventional view of what art does in terms of helping us experience empathy or causing us to experience empathy. You push back against this view, and the way you do it at the very beginning of this essay, The Banality of Empathy, is to talk about watching an episode of a TV show. The TV show is called Black Mirror. It's dystopian. What were you watching, and what was your experience as you watched it?
So I've been a fan of this show for a while. I like science fiction and I like dystopia a great deal. And I was watching Bandersnatch, which is the newest episode of Black Mirror, which is an experiment in terms of media, because even though it is operating just like a TV show that you would watch on Netflix, it also allows for an interactive experience, which is quite similar to a kind of video game. And it's also alluding specifically to the Choose Your Own Adventure books. And so the episode kind of takes you through the life of a young white man who's trying to make it as a video game programmer in the 80s in London. And at various points, it offers you a kind of binary choice for him. Which cereal does he want to eat? Which album does he want to purchase and listen to? Does he want to follow someone that he's just met, or does he rather want to go into his therapist's office and discuss his mother? And at each point that these decisions arise, a black menu bar comes up and you have to click on it as the viewer, and you have a kind of timeline or a kind of hourglass that make sure that you make that decision within, I think, something like 30 seconds. And
what if you don't make that decision?
Then the show just kind of makes its own choice and keeps going. So there are obviously going to be different paths that you can follow through the show. And what I found really interesting about experiencing this work of narrative art is that it made very explicit the decision points that usually a novel just takes you through or a TV show just makes you track, but you actually had some kind of agency. And I felt very uncomfortable with a specific decision point, which involved whether or not to, as the character, choose to jump off the balcony or to make another character jump. And either way, someone was going to die. And in that moment, I felt really I had a lot of anxiety about the fact that my agency as a reader or a viewer was going to actually impact the action and was going to affect what seemed like someone's life. And so this empathy model of narrative was suddenly made very explicit to me in that moment. Here I was identifying with this character, and I had to make a choice, a life or death choice. And I didn't actually choose. I abdicated that choice in that moment. And I can't remember what the show did, but someone died. And then we just went back to the last menu. And over time, these choices became much easier for me. The stark choice of whether or not someone with clear kind of mental instability should be taking a tab of acid or should be seeing their therapist or, again, should do something that was going to put their life in danger. The more I watched the show, the less I cared about this character's actual life. It became almost a kind of matter of interest or pleasure narratively. And it made me realize that actually most art, if we're really, really going to empathize with the character, would force you into this kind of position, because so much plot involves death and so much plot involves putting people in actual danger. So kind of undid for me this idea that narrative works of art primarily exist for readers or viewers to feel empathy with the character. Because most of the time, I think what we have a much more distanced view of what's happening on the screen or on the page. And at the end of the day, they aren't real people. And so we're much more likely to enjoy the killing, say, of a character on Game of Thrones than we might express shock and dismay. But at the end of the day, we're not actually feeling grief or mourning.
That's Namwali Sirpal. She is an award-winning Zambian writer and an associate professor of English at UC Berkeley. And she wrote an essay entitled The Banality of Empathy. It appeared on the NYR, that's the New York Review Daily website. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So are you saying that it's impossible to truly empathize with a fictional character, or are you saying that there's an issue of relatability that, you know, only if a character is relatable in some way to me, the viewer or the reader, can I actually empathize with that character?
I think what we're experiencing when we read or watch a piece of narrative art isn't truly empathy. I think it's a simulation of empathy. And I think if we were to probe what is actually going on in the mind when we're experiencing a work of art, it would not be identical to what it feels like to empathize with another human being in person. And that's a good thing, actually, because real human beings are not the same thing as characters. And, you know, there's a wonderful literary scholar and philosopher named Candace Vogler who says, quote, "I will be making an ethical mistake if I take myself to have the kind of grasp of a person that fiction makes available to me in my engagements with imaginary people. No human being will be knowable in the way that any literary character worth repeated readings is knowable." So we can't ever actually know another person in real life. But fiction makes us feel the illusion that we can feel what they're feeling, that we can empathize with their experience. But that kind of vicarious experiencing is not something that is, A, possible in real life, nor is it actually ethical to try and enforce in real life. That we often call it appropriating the experiences of others when we try to occupy them the way that we would a narrator or a character in a work of art. So I think there's a kind of problem of analogy. We think that what we're doing when we're reading is the same as what we're doing in life, but actually they're quite different and they should be different.
A character in a novel by Tom McCarthy, the novel is Remainder, he actually tries to occupy, it seems, the being or the reality of somebody. In this case, a guy who died, who was murdered. This was a black man who was murdered. The kind of, quote, hero of the novel Remainder is actually a rich white guy. What does he try and do in order to try and stand in the shoes of this man who died?
So he performs throughout the novel Remainder these acts of reenactment. He describes them as reenactment. So he learns about the murder of a young black man in Brixton, I think, in London. And he decides to hire two men to pretend to assassinate him, to kill him in the same way that this man had died. And they use, you know, fake bullets, and they take their time to murder him. And he makes them repeat it, to reenact it over and over again. And then he lies down on the ground where the dead man lay, and he tries to absorb what the dead man would have seen in his last moments. And this scene, I think, really kind of brilliantly illustrates the reductio ad absurdum of the idea of empathy. Like, if you take it to the extreme that I'm going to put myself in someone's position to reenact their death, creates this really chilling and eerie effect when you're reading the novel. He talks about how neutral the ground is, how it's neither warm nor cold. And he keeps seeing the word escape, which is over a door. It's like a fire escape. And he keeps repeating this word. Would my man have seen this just before the life dribbled out of him? You know, would he have seen this word escape? And it sort of gives you a sense of what it actually would mean to take on the position of another in this very literal way. And what it is it's actually perverse. There's a kind of darkness to it. And that's McCarthy's own word for what his character feels. He says he's deeply moved by this guy's death in a perverse way. And I think if you take empathy to its kind of logical endpoint as a literary phenomenon, I think this scene shows you what it actually would look like.
Yeah, and I think you put it at some point in your essay as this character, this rich white male, is in a sense kind of relishing the suffering of somebody else.
Yeah, I think, you know, the term that I have used for this is a kind of ethical slumming. You know, we know what it means to slum for pleasure, right? To go and to hang out with people you wouldn't normally hang out with. It's usually a class term about hanging out with the disenfranchised people in society who somehow have more fun than the rich people. But to ethically slum, I think, is to kind of delectate or enjoy the suffering of others in this representational way with this kind of distance. You're safe from the actual suffering of the character, but you get to experience it vicariously by reading or by watching. And there's a kind of perversion, I think, or perversity to that. And I think most people don't believe themselves to be engaging in that when they're just reading a novel about someone who is suffering. But when you actually take a look at the rhetoric around certain kinds of texts, especially by marginalized people, by trans folk, by Black people, by POC in general, people of color, by women, there's a sense in which when I'm reading this book and I'm empathizing with them, I'm usually being asked to empathize with their pain. What does that say about the way that representation works in contemporary fiction and art? Why must people who suffer kind of display their suffering so that people who don't suffer can enjoy that in the space of art?
Well, isn't that part of the, in some cases, the artist's or the writer's agenda, that they want to make or help the consumer of that art feel a certain way and feel the suffering so that they can do something to alleviate the suffering of real people in the real world?
I think that's the idea, and I do think that there is something commendable about that impulse. But I personally, and maybe this is just cynical of me, I personally don't think it works. And I also think it creates a certain kind of pandering in the artwork, right? So if I'm representing the suffering of someone in order that a reader or a viewer then empathize with that suffering and then go out once they're finished with the artwork and try to change the world, that presumes certain things. It presumes that the person who is viewing the art is not suffering, right? And that they have the capacity to experience that suffering, step away from it, and still feel somehow inspired to go and relieve it in other people. So, you know, one question that one might pose is, for whom are these works of art being created? To whom am I pandering? Who am I trying to teach how to empathize with the suffering of the disenfranchised? Is there a kind of imbalance built into a model whereby the purpose of art is to engender empathy in only one particular kind of audience?
Her name is Namwali Sirpal. She is a novelist, a short story writer, an essayist. She teaches English at UC Berkeley. And her debut novel, just published, is The Old Drift. And we are focusing today mostly on an essay that she wrote about empathy that appeared in a recent online issue of NYR Daily. And I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So at some point in this essay, you kind of turn toward maybe a better, a more interesting way of looking at what literature can do to, for example, the reader, and what it can instill in the reader that might be positive, that might open up new vistas. You kind of begin this project by looking at Paul Bloom, who wrote in 2016 a book called Against Empathy. That's a provocative title. Did he think there's only one kind of empathy?
So he breaks empathy down into two distinct categories, emotional empathy and cognitive empathy. And he is a cognitive psychologist himself, so he's looking at many different case studies and research about how empathy actually works between people. And something I found really helpful about this very bracing argument, as you note, in Against Empathy, was that emotional empathy is usually what we mean when we use the term empathy. We mean feeling for other people or feeling as other people. But Paul Bloom points out that there is also a version of empathy, which is to just simply think as somebody else, to put yourself in someone's position. And the distinction between thinking and feeling empathically, I think, is very important to me as a writer and as a thinker. I think we believe that novels are meant to make us feel things, but I think they can also make us think in interesting and new ways.
And so how would some kind of identification with the character, in the sense of maybe understanding their perspective, how might that help us in a way that's different than, you know, we assimilate with them, we stand in their shoes?
Well, so actually, I think standing in their shoes in that old sense is the better model. So I think we used to talk about walking a mile in another person's shoes, and we used to talk about standing in their shoes as a version of empathy. And now we have this much more intense becoming someone. You know, you're not just adopting their position or feeling what it's like to wear the specific shoes that they have or to walk a specific mile in their lives, but we're meant to feel for them, to cry. And this is a big theme, is that, you know, a film that makes you cry about the suffering of others is somehow morally better. So I think going back to this slightly less emotional way of identifying with characters would actually be more politically astute for us, especially in the 21st century. So I look to the work of Hannah Arendt, who had a kind of really strong distaste for sentimentality of all kinds. So she really didn't like the idea of being pitied or of emotional appeals, displays of suffering in order to get people to care about you. She even says, you know, I have never in my life loved any people or collective. So this kind of emotional way of thinking about other people was something she really pushed against. But she was interested in what she thought of as literature's special talent for adopting the viewpoints of others. But again, more in this intellectual or in a more thoughtful way rather than a feeling way. So she talked about what she described as representative thinking. And she saw literature as having the capacity to engender this opening up of your mind to encompass the positions of others. And if you think about it as a kind of political theory rather than as an ethical theory, I think that also helps in terms of how she distinguishes representation from empathy. So I'm going to quote her here. I'll try to read it slowly because it's as a lot of Arendt's work is quite dense. So she says, "This process of representation does not blindly adopt the actual views of those who stand somewhere else and hence look upon the world from a different perspective. This is a question neither of empathy, as though I try to be or feel like somebody else, nor of counting noses and joining a majority. Rather," she says, "it's a matter of, quote, being and thinking in my own identity where actually I am not." So it's about putting yourself as yourself in someone else's perspective. But you're not feeling their feelings. You don't necessarily even believe what they believe. You're simply putting yourself in their position to see what you would think if you were in that position.
And there's a kind of, and I think you find this valuable, there's a kind of distance between you and the novelist, the filmmaker, that preserves a kind of integrity to you.
Yes, and to them, and to the character as well, right? So there's a sense that you're relating to other people as individuals, as separate from you, not trying to occupy their position, as in Tom McCarthy's character kind of lying on the ground where a dead man had lain and trying to feel all of the feelings that he felt. But rather, what would it mean to simply exist in that position? So Arendt describes this as going visiting. One trains one's imagination to go visiting. And I like the word visiting because it's not tourism exactly. It's not just, you know, going someplace and kind of staring at the slums or treating it as a tourist attraction. But nor is it this occupation of another person. It's, you're not assimilating yourself to the other person. It's literally like you traveling outside of your circumstances and you're visiting someone else's circumstances, but you know, you stay for a while. You don't just pass by, but you go where you're welcome. I think visiting has this quality of being hosted, which I think really gives a different tint to Arendt's notion of representational thinking. It's something that's more geared toward, again, a politics of bringing to mind different perspectives on what it means to live without necessarily taking over or assuming the experience of another person.
And what does having those multiplicity of perspectives, what does having them or being able to bring them to bear in considering an issue and the opinion you want to form on that issue, what does that do to the ability of a person to get more to the truth of the matter?
Yeah, for Arendt, this was very much about a disinterested pursuit of the truth, right? So if I think we tend toward this in how we think about law, right? When we have multiple opinions on a case, or when you have multiple witnesses to a crime, this idea that the more perspectives you have, the more you can see life fully in the round, you can see a kind of truthfulness, and it gives you, as close as possible, a sense of impartiality. For Arendt, she saw it as a kind of disinterested pursuit of truth that happens only when you can assume the perspective of other people, but as yourself, again, right? There's no sense that you're going to be becoming another person or losing yourself. It's really about seeing things all the way around, being able to understand an issue from multiple sides, as people often like to say. And I want to note, though, it does not equate necessarily all of those sides. So it's not both sidesism, a term that I think is very relevant but also very contentious at the moment. You're always aware of who is your friend and who is your foe in Arendt's perspective. You're always aware of the injustices of the world. And you're not putting yourself in someone's position in order to justify their way of being or simply to accuse another of making them suffer. Rather, you're doing this in order to get to the truth. The political function of the storyteller, in Arendt's view, is to see the truth of things.
That's the voice of Namwali Sirpel. She is a novelist, short story writer, born in Lusaka, Zambia, now lives in the Bay Area, teaches English. She's an associate professor of English at UC Berkeley. We'll take a short break and speak more with her about empathy, about literature, about art. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. My guest in studio is Namwali Sirpel, Namwali Sirpell. She is a Zambian writer. She is an associate professor of English at UC Berkeley, and her short stories have been published widely. Her writing has appeared in such publications as The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, N Plus One, and The Guardian. She's also written a book of literary criticism with the title Seven Modes of Uncertainty. Her debut novel is just out. It's called The Old Drift, and she wrote an essay entitled The Banality of Empathy, kind of like Arendt's The Banality of Evil, that appeared on the NYR Daily website. So let's say we wanted art and literature to promote Arendt's thinking about representation and about having more perspectives to bring to bear on a topic or an issue that we're trying to think through. What would that mean? Like, what might we need to see more of, for example, in fiction or in film?
So I think opening up representation generally would work really well to help us achieve what Arendt calls representational thinking. So one can only bring the experiences of others to mind if one has access to those experiences, right? But I think greater variety of experience as such would be really helpful for us when we're thinking about literature and narrative art in particular. So on one hand, we do want more representations of people who have been historically marginalized. We definitely want to have a greater variety of perspectives on the world, from people of color, from queer folk, from trans folk, from people whose minds and bodies have not appeared in art as much, despite being, in some cases, a majority. So we have this kind of distribution of representation at the moment where we have the default human as usually the straight white male hero, and they're allowed to be good or evil. And then we have everybody else who is essentially presented in a form of suffering. And in their suffering, we are to empathize with them. And I think, you know, why not have a greater variety of not just people being represented, but also a greater variety of experiences? So why not have texts that show poor people that are happy or Black people in love? You know, there's so much range of experience available to us in our actual lives, but on screen it gets really delimited to this, you know, white male hero portrayal of a full, rich, often contradictory life. And on the other hand, everybody else, and they're kind of these empathy vehicles that we're supposed to feel their pain and feel their sorrow and feel their suffering so that we can remedy the inequalities in our everyday lives.
You like a sci-fi short story written by Violet Allen called The Venus Effect. Tell us what happens in that story and how it might help us get to a horizon of greater representation or a greater sense of awareness about representation.
So this science fiction story by Violet Allen entitled The Venus Effect, I think it offers a great example of the kind of representation and representational thinking that we should aspire to, insofar as it is interesting, dynamic, and kind of radical art. But I actually think it's a better example of a story that diagnoses the problem, in that it takes us through multiple iterations of a story. You basically are following a writer figure as they try to write a story about a Black superhero whose name is Apollo Allen. And it offers something like 8 different subsections, each of which are potential versions of an adventure story about Apollo Allen and a girl from Venus. And the first version of this story has Apollo at a rooftop party, up on a roof, and he catches sight of a love interest who's dancing very close to the edge, and he's the only person at the party that sees her fall. He goes to the edge of the roof and watches as she speeds toward the ground, then just stops and hangs in the air, then gently lowers herself and races off. So this is the girl from Venus, right? So you have this really tantalizing setup already. Apollo chases after her, but then there's this unexpected twist. There's a man in a police uniform standing at the corner of the street. Apollo doesn't see the man in the police uniform. The man in the police uniform draws his weapon and pulls the trigger and strikes Apollo, doing critical damage to his heart and lungs. And the story simply says he is dead now. And then this wry kind of writerly voice intrudes and says, wait, what? What happened? I was just writing a story and suddenly there's a cop shooting my main character. This isn't what's supposed to happen. So the writerly voice kind of tries again and writes a new version of the story and tries to make Apollo a little bit more of a kind of goody two-shoes. This time he's a basketball player instead of someone at a party. And the story even edits his language so that he's a bit more positive. So instead of saying holy shit, he says golly. And Apollo again discovers an alien woman after her ship has crashed. But while he's gathering supplies to heal her, he's again accosted by a police officer. And this just keeps happening over and over.
He's killed again?
Yeah. And this keeps happening over and over. And again, we have these kind of metafictional asides from the writer figure who breaks in and kind of ponders, you know, why is it that this keeps happening to my character? Is it that they're not relatable because it's a black man? Maybe he did something silly. Maybe he shouldn't have reached for his wallet in that one version of the story. So the writer tries to make Apollo into different versions of a hero to try to make Apollo more relatable. So at one point, the writer makes Apollo a child because everyone's been a child. That makes them super relatable. But even still, Apollo gets shot. The writer makes Apollo kind of part of a multicultural, gender-inclusive Justice League, but Apollo still gets shot. At some point, Apollo is made into a woman, Apollonia, but it's still every instance of the story, this figure gets interrupted by a police officer. And the writer figure begins to despair. You know, how can I possibly make this figure relatable enough that they won't get killed by the end of the story? And I found this story really illuminating in a very similar way to the way I found Bandersnatch, because again, we're confronted with multiple instances of a character dying, but here we have the writer figure coming in to talk about the very question of empathy that circled around my watching experience with Bandersnatch, bringing up the question of whether a character is relatable, bringing up the question of whether we as readers or viewers are responsible for what happens to these characters. And I thought there's this kind of beautiful way that that Alan's story draws our attention to the very structure of the story and the way that it cannot be made analogous to real life, that the story cannot go on if we actually take into account what would truly happen to a black female or a black male character put in this position. So it kind of keeps reminding us that this is just a story, but at the same time reminds us that empathizing with this character will never be enough to prevent young black people from being shot by police once you close the laptop, once you close the book.
Namwale Serpell is my guest. She is a writer. She teaches English at UC Berkeley, and she wrote an essay entitled The Banality of Empathy. And we will put a link to that essay on our website, againstthegrain.org. Well, Bertolt Brecht, he also called attention to the actual mechanics of the writing of, in this case, his plays, highlighting the stage, the props, these kinds of things. Why did he do that? I mean, didn't he want his viewers to be immersed in the play and not to think about all the stuff that goes on behind the making of the plot?
So Brecht's aesthetic innovation was to try to disrupt the immersion that we usually think is the purpose of narrative art, that we want to lose ourselves in the characters or lose ourselves in the story. He wanted the audience to always be aware that they were in a theater and that what they were seeing was not real life. And part of what he was trying to do is prevent us from expelling all of our feelings, you know, in what literary critics have long called catharsis, which is from Aristotle's idea that when you go to the theater, you feel all of these feelings, you feel pity and fear for the hero who suffers on stage, and that this helps us get rid of these dangerous feelings, pity and fear. Brecht thought, well, no, I don't want you to leave the theater feeling drained of emotion. I want you to leave the theater ready to start a riot. And so by continually reminding us that we're not actually living real life here, you're not just feeling your feelings in this space, that you are actually watching characters who are enacting things for you on stage, this alienation effect or estrangement effect, as it's sometimes translated, for Brecht was really important to make sure that theater served a political function, that it wasn't just this place where we would cleanse ourselves or feel this kind of palliative effect of feeling pity or fear for the characters.
In other words, Brecht really also opposed this notion of empathy, this mind meld with any character that he presented.
Yes, I think the receptive experience for Brecht should involve this measure of distance, right? This estrangement or alienation from what's happening on stage. The idea being that if you meld with the characters on stage, you're going to release all of this emotion, all of this energy, and what that leaves you is spent, really. You have nothing left to give. And this is something that a philosopher that some of us may be familiar with, Rousseau, actually said this about empathy, several centuries ago. So he said, quote, "In giving our tears to these fictions, we have satisfied all the rights of humanity without having to give anything more of ourselves. Unfortunate people in person would require attention from us, relief, consolation, and work, which would involve us in our pains and would require at least the sacrifice of our indolence." So there's a sense that, you know, if you waste all your tears on characters and the page, you're not going to have anything left for the people in the street. And I think there's a very clear picture of this. If you imagine going into a movie theater and watching, say, a film about slavery and weeping at the suffering of slaves in the 19th century in the U.S., and then you cry and you feel this horrible anguish, but you're basically cleansed of those emotions when you leave the theater, and then you see a homeless person on the street. And we don't always make the connection between the person that we were watching on screen, an actor, you know, performing suffering, with the person who's actually suffering right outside the movie theater. And for Brecht, you know, he wanted to make sure that you didn't cry out all of your feelings in the theater, that when you left the theater, you were able to perceive and feel angry about the suffering around you that's happening to real people. So it was very much about seeing and thinking and perceiving things in a political way rather than simply experiencing things in this emotional way that sometimes offers a kind of escape valve for our actual human responsibilities to real people.
Yeah, do you think that when someone cries when one watches a film about slavery, that it is in some ways a gratifying thing, that it somehow helps them feel better about themselves? Oh, look, I cried at someone else's suffering, therefore I'm some kind of a better person?
I do. I think that's very human. And I do believe in the power of narrative art to move us to tears. And that, I think, isn't something I want us to do away with, you know? I just think we need to decouple that from our actual responsibilities to human beings. I think seeing them as correlated gives us a kind of excuse to believe that we're doing something good, to believe that we're being responsible or ethical human beings, simply by watching a movie or reading a book. Of course, I'm a writer. Of course, I want to experience, you know, other people when I'm writing. You know, empathy is a big part of how I construct my narrative. So I don't believe that we want to do away with empathy altogether. But I do think it's important for us to separate out the kind of catharsis of emotion that we feel when we're watching a work of art, separate that from what we're actually doing on the ground. I think watching a protest on screen and going to a protest in person are radically different things.
That's Namwali Sirpel talking about an essay she wrote entitled The Banality of Empathy. I also asked Sirpel about her new novel, The Old Drift. We don't have time to present all of that Q&A, so we'll do that in a future program. But I do have a couple minutes to share with you this excerpt, beginning with Namwali explaining to me that the Old Drift refers to a place.
The Old Drift is now a cemetery, and it's on the banks of the Zambezi River in Central Africa, in Zambia, where I'm from. And It is the last vestige of an old colonial settlement that was there in the late 19th century, where people from all over the world, from India, from Germany, there was even a man from Chicago, and the first hotel manager of the Victoria Falls Hotel was an Italian man named Pietro Gavuzzi, and, you know, people from England as well. And they all were in this on the banks of the river there in this small settlement, and it was called the Old Drift because a drift is the narrowest and calmest part of a river where you can drift things across. So people were coming from southern Africa, from what is now Zimbabwe, which is at the time was Rhodesia. They were coming into this new territory and they were settling there. And so my novel begins in that colonial settlement.
And it involves three families. Why three families? And tell us about these clans that dominate the narrative over a period of generations.
So I wanted to write a story that captured the cosmopolitanism of my country, because I think people's understanding of African countries is pretty limited, of Zambia is very limited. And I wanted to give people a sense that my country was always a place where people from all over the world were in contact, sometimes violent contact, and this kind of collision of peoples from all over, but sometimes more romantic convergences. Interracial love is a big part of my novel. So the forefathers of these three families first encounter each other at the Old Drift in the Victoria Falls Hotel. A British man named Percy Clark, who's a historical figure whose book, The Autobiography of an Old Drifter, forms the basis for the first chapter of my novel. He was in the Old Drift trying to make his fortune as a photographer, and he comes into contact with Pietro Gavuzzi, who is the hotelier of the Victoria Falls Hotel, and a Tonga busboy named Ngulube, who is mentioned in Percy Clark's autobiography. So these three men come into contact with each other, and by a set of accidents or chance events, they come into contact and they collide. And this sets off what I describe as a kind of cycle of unwitting retribution between their respective descendants. And this path of oblique interaction moves between the three families over the course of multiple generations until it swirls down into in kind of vortex fashion to a love triangle between the three last descendants, and they're all trying to start a political revolution, and this shifts the novel into a near future Zambia.
Namwali Serpell, spelled Namwali Serpell, talking about her new novel, her debut novel, The Old Drift. Namwali is also an associate professor of English at UC Berkeley. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.